Grief, it's something that affects everyone, no matter how old you are, what your social status may be, where you come from. Mourning over the loss of a loved one or dealing with the pain of a broken heart really hurts. But how much does it hurt? And what does it take to get through it? Some have said single-parent homes have conditioned millennials to be better at dealing with grief when it happens. They're better equipped when compared to generations that came before them. While other studies point to millennials actually having a harder time when it comes to dealing with sadness and depression because of maybe the quick emotional turnaround time demanded by social media. So which one is it? Is it easier for millennials, for young people to mourn, to overcome sadness? Or is it harder? Let's have a heart and soul conversation. You're listening to Heart and Soul, a podcast from the Iglesia Cristo Church of Christ. I'm your host, Martin Zeruto, and I'll be interviewing young adults from across the world who are living Christian lives, but are also dealing with real world problems. This is Heart and Soul. Welcome to Heart and Soul. My name is Martin Zeruto. I'm your host, and our guest today is Constance Joy. Constance Joy is 31 years old. She's a registered nurse working in South Atlanta, enjoys writing, talking with family, baby therapy, which I think is hanging out with your niece, Constance Joy,
and
capoeira, which I believe is a Brazilian form of martial art, right?
Yep.
There you go.
Got it.
Hi, Constance Joy. How are you today?
Hey, what's up? What's up? I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Very good. Thank you so much. And we also have joining us today, Minister of the Gospel, Brother Bob. Hi, Brother Bob.
Greetings to you both, and welcome everyone to this. I believe, is it not Martin, the first episode of this season for Heart and Soul?
It
I'm
is.
Glad to be with you today.
Yes, we're happy to have you on our very first season premiere, our episode for Heart and Soul after we've come back. Now, for those who have not met the amazing Brother Bob, he's an ordained minister of the gospel, host of That's in the Bible, which can be found on incmedia.org, husband and granddad to five, former Air Force and forever Buffalo Bills fan. Is that true? Forever?
Oh, yes.
No matter what.
That's right.
Now, the topic of our episode today is millennials in mourning, why dealing with grief has gotten easier and also harder. Now, millennials, as you know, continue to get a lot of flack from other generations. You're too loud, not loud enough, you're entitled, you're not working hard enough, not enough experience, not willing to work for free, you're lazy, on and on and on and on. Now, before we go on, Brother Bob, why do you think, as somebody who's not part of the millennial generation, why do you think millennials or young people today get so much flack?
Well, I think I cannot disagree with you there, but Martin, that they really do get stereotypical perceptions levied upon them. You know, I hear that often from those my age. I'm in my 60s now, that particular generation of all generations is lazier than any other. I cannot deny what you just said there, that they do get that stigmatism levied upon them. But I'm not so sure that it's always truly warranted. You know, I got five grandchildren, three of them anyway, are in that age bracket. And, you know, they work hard. I see others working hard. But then, you know, as the saying goes, you know, well, I don't know if it's a modern saying, but, you know, I'm saying that like one bad apple spoils the whole bunch.
That's
you know?
Right.
Sometimes people have a tendency to look at just a handful of those they may know and give that stereotypical perception levied upon all millennials. Millennials are of the future. They're going to be running the country and running the world in just a short lick of time here. So I guess we better stop talking about them that way. What do you think?
Absolutely. Constance Joy, have you ever experienced that? You know, 31 years old, having gone through your teens and your college years, have you gotten that perception from other generations that maybe you guys are not doing enough? You're not working hard enough. You're entitled.
Totally. Yes, totally. Especially jumping into the working force, I've experienced those perceptions. And I think it's because our generation of millennials are kind of like between worlds or between generations. Like our childhood was carefree. Like
pre-internet.
Pre-internet, exactly. Like we didn't have the influence of social media. And then when it was introduced to us around preteen years or high school years, that's when things were, you know, with social media were brand new. We started connecting with other people through different means, and, you know, access to knowledge was at our fingertips.
That's right.
Yeah, that's one thing that I would not disagree with, okay? That millennials have a challenge interacting with other people because they spend so much time online and interacting online, not having to deal with face-to-face communications, that they are no longer adapted to, or they're no longer comfortable in social settings. That I would agree with. And I think that has to do exactly with what you just said, that the new world is online.
Yeah, I agree completely. Like, there's a lot of people who have a lot of social anxiety and don't really know how to take on social cues and communicate with people face to face, or, you know, talking over the phone. A lot of it is through text.
You know, what's actually interesting, actually, for a lot of Ivy League and for those who are in very scientific or tech intensive majors, you know, they have really great grades. They want to continue their career after they've graduated out of these really top schools. But they have to take social classes, to what you were referring to, Brother Bob, is that, you know, they have all the qualifications to get that interview. They get there, they have to look at a human person and interact, and they have absolutely no idea how to convey their skills or their personality to be hired because their whole life has been looking at a screen, not talking to people.
Right, exactly.
Now, for our listeners, you know, wherever side you may lean on, you know, in terms of the state of our of the world and the generation coming up that's going to be leading it, what we have to accept, of course, is that millennials, like all generations, have to deal with grief. And it's a topic that many our age, Constance Joy, both of us being in our early 30s, sometimes have a hard time talking about. Constance Joy has come here today to talk about the two kinds of loss that she's gone through and the depression and the sadness that came after it. How about we start off with your dad, Constance Joy? Tell us a little bit about your relationship with your dad and what came about near the end.
So my life in a nutshell is my family and my faith. Growing up, my family was really tight. We were really close. So I grew up very blessed with my dad, my mom, and my two older brothers. And, you know, growing up, I saw my parents as my superheroes. I still do. So my dad, he was like the life of the party. You know, he told all the corny dad jokes. He was like the king of those cheesy dad jokes. We would watch movies all the time. And I remember this one movie we watched was Meet Joe Black. Do you know that movie?
Yes, with Brad Pitt.
Yeah. So like, I loved like those kinds of movies. So like we got up to the box office and my dad's like, "Hello there. I'd like to meet Joe Black at 7 o'clock. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, corny dad joke. But it was like my favorite, you know, and we would sing karaoke together. We would sing like all the duets together, like the Natalie Cole and Nat King Cole songs.
Unforgettable.
Yeah. And, you know, he taught me how to cha-cha to Stevie Wonder's My Cherie Amour.
Wow.
And my childhood was filled with moments like that, was filled with so much love from my dad.
What would you say is the first memory that you have of your father?
The first memory that I have of my dad was him sitting my brothers and me down after church and speaking to us about a Bible story. And it was, I think it was about, he told us a lot of Bible stories. So he got us really excited to learn about our faith that way through stories. And he was a great storyteller. And so I just remember him really putting an emphasis on what our faith is and what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a member of the Church of Christ, and applying those things in our life.
What would he say?
He mentioned to us how God performs miracles in our lives. Maybe not in the same way that he did in Moses' time, you know, parting of the Red Sea and all that. But if we open our eyes and if we realize, you know, the blessings in our lives, it's God's miracles in our lives. So that was one of the many lessons that he taught me growing up. Other memories that I had of him, especially, you know, in church or faith related, was he was a deacon in our church and he was an overseer. So he would always bring me along with him to visit the brethren.
Oh, wow.
And I was still in the children's worship service, a little shy, little kid. And he would assign me to pray for the first prayer of our meetings. And I would be so scared.
How old were you at the time?
I was only like maybe 6 or 7 years old.
Wow.
He would tell me, you know, don't be scared to pray. Don't be scared to talk to God. You know, it's a blessing. It's a good thing to talk to God. Don't be scared. So it really brought me out of my shell it helped me with public speaking. It helped me connect with people, being able to pray for them. My dad instilled that in me, and he instilled in me the love of the brotherhood, because I would see him interacting with the brethren and really asking them, how are you? And really listening and really caring about what they say.
Right, right. What about your first couple of years going into high school, grade 9? It's a lot of pressure. Did it give you any kind of dad talks before you entered into that new stage in your life?
So going into high school, I remember him giving me that, you know, boy talk.
What did he say?
He asked me, he said, what do you think is the greatest test of love? And I said, I don't know, distance, you know, like distance makes the heart grow fonder.
That's what you told him at 14?
Yeah. And then my dad said, nope. And I was like, I don't know, like fighting, like, going through arguments and like getting through those fights together. But he was like, nope. And I was like, I don't know, daddy, I don't know what. And then he said, time. Time is the greatest test for love, because if you start out really falling for someone, having those feelings for them, and then as time passes, you know, things will happen. Only time will tell.
And how did you take that advice at 14?
Well, I didn't realize what he was saying until I actually experienced it. So he told me that time will tell. And then if it doesn't work out in the end, then, you know, at least it wasn't a waste of time, because you learn what you don't want in a relationship, or you learn from that experience. And then if it does, you know, work out in the end, then it was all worth the wait. And, you know, not only like our time, you know, but in God's time.
Right.
So, yeah. So that was one of the many things that I've taken from my advice from my dad. So time and being, you know, patiently enduring, especially God's time, will test our love.
When did you guys find out?
So when I was 15 years old, my dad was rushed to the emergency room. He was having symptoms, and, you know, he was really young. He was 39 years old at the time. So the symptoms that he was experiencing, the doctors didn't think that it was, you know, cancer related, or we didn't have to worry about cancer at all because he was young.
What were the symptoms?
He was bleeding and abdominal pain and everything. So they ran some tests, and then they found a huge mass in his colon. I remember when my mom and dad found out, and they brought me and my brothers inside his hospital room. They were very lighthearted about it. And, you know, they wanted to show to us that we had nothing to worry about. You know, they didn't want us to be scared. They, especially my mom, she just thought it would just be, you know, another bump in the road that our family would have to go through.
What was that conversation like? What did they say?
Well, my dad, you know, being the joker that he is, he showed us a picture of that mass, and he was like, look at this, I have an alien in my body. Ha ha ha. And so it was like, you know, like awkward laugh, like, ha ha ha, but that's really scary. But, you know, like I understand, you know, like they just wanted us to not worry. They didn't want us to be scared. So we followed their lead. We didn't worry because we knew that God was on our side. We knew that we had our family prayers. We had our support system with our extended family. And, you know, in the Church of Christ, we ask for anointing of oil from the elders, and right, they pray for us. So we did all of that throughout his treatment. So after that diagnosis, they planned for surgery.
Right.
After that surgery was the treatment, the radiation, the chemotherapy.
What was the what was the prayer like that day after you found out about the mass in his stomach?
The prayer was just so full of faith that we did not doubt at all that God would heal him.
Right.
That we would survive this, and we would just keep on keeping on, you know, after the surgery, after, you know, throughout the treatment. So we moved back to California to be with our extended family, and our extended family there in San Pablo. And we would have family devotional prayers, family anointing of oils at the chapel.
How often?
We would do it like once a week. And then especially if my dad had some sort of test or procedure, we would do it through like every day throughout the week.
How was that for you as a high school student, you know, moving to a new school, knowing your dad was undergoing the treatment? What was going to school like? What were the thoughts in your mind while all of this was happening?
So going to school, it wasn't really a new school because I lived in California before we had moved to Las Vegas and then back to California. So I still had my friends that I had in middle school, and I didn't really talk to them about what my dad was experiencing. I spoke with my cousins about it because they were like my brothers and sisters, and they saw my dad as like a second parent. So we were experiencing this all together as a family. But in regards to school, I didn't really focus on school at the time. It wasn't really a priority in my life. And I just cared about my family. You know, I was just going through the motions because that was, you know, I had to go to school. That was like my job as a kid. But I wasn't really into academics until college.
Right. So the treatments were happening. Were there signs that he was getting better, or were there signs that he wasn't getting better?
So after a year, it seemed like he was gaining more weight. He was looking very healthy and looking like he was healthy and happy and back to normal.
Was he bedridden? He was able to move around, or?
He was able to move around, and he looked great. He looked like he was healing. He felt like he was healing. And then maybe like a year after his first surgery, they did another imaging test and they saw that the cancer had spread to other organs. And then at that time, I think it wasn't so lighthearted anymore. It was more serious. You know, we didn't expect for this news. We expected for him, for those results to show that he was completely healed and in remission. And we just had to, you know, keep up with treatments. And
can you walk us through that day? How you guys found out? Where were you and what did they say?
So after that time, when my parents told us that the cancer had spread, we continued our devotional prayers and we continued to have this faith, like, you know, God will show miracles in our lives, just like what my dad taught me when I was younger. And from then, my dad had another surgery because his condition was getting worse. It wasn't getting better from there. So he had another surgery, and then he wasn't responding to the regular regimens of treatment. So he signed up for clinical trials, and then he continued to get worse from there. So I would go with my mom and dad to his appointments. And then this one day I was with them. We met with his oncologist. So one day...
It's okay.
So one day my mom and I went with my dad to his appointment to meet with his oncologist again. And in that appointment, the doctor just broke the news and told my dad he only had a few months to live.
That must have been quite hard, I suppose. Huh?
It was something I've never experienced or never seen my parents go through, because like I said earlier, my parents are my superheroes. You know, when you're young, you see your parents as these powerful, superhuman people. Nothing can touch them. And then that day, I saw my dad cry for the first time, and I saw him for being human. And I realized this was something like really serious. And my mom, like strong as she is, she's a rock, and she was still, you know, by my dad's side, still comforting him, saying that it'll be okay. And so I still, in my heart, I still hoped against all hope, and I still prayed to God that he'll perform a miracle. That's what we continued to do. And when we got home that day, my dad called his mom, his brothers and sisters, all my cousins. And so all my family was gathered in my house, and my dad shared the news with them that the doctor told him he only was given a limited amount of time. And the whole room just was just so full of sadness and tears. And I remember everybody was in our family room, and I was just sitting on our stairs, just watching everyone break down and cry. And I was crying too, but I still, in my heart, I was like, no, no, he's not going to die. And then my dad said to all of us, he said, today we cry, but tomorrow is a new day. And I want all of you to smile and be happy because we still have this time together. And he said, I don't want you to remember me in this sickly state. I don't want you to remember me this way. I want you to remember me as the man who loves all of you.
Right.
And so we listened to my dad, and in the darkest, saddest times, like for some reason, some way, somehow, my family is able to turn things around and you know, find a way to still laugh about things and enjoy life. So, you know, we had our, you know, family get-togethers, our family parties with our soul food. And again, we continued to pray as a family. During that time, you know, the doctor told us he had maybe 6 months to live, when in reality, he only had like 2 months.
Oh, man.
And then as his condition continued to get worse, I just remember sitting in the choir loft and seeing my dad in the back row with his oxygen. You know, he still continued to attend worship service. And I know, like, before then, like, he was still performing as a deacon as much as he could, still performing his duties until he just physically couldn't anymore. That's what I remember the most, is even though he was physically dwindling and becoming more weak, his spirit was the strongest ever. So that's what I remembered. In those moments when he was about to pass away, he was placed on home hospice, so he was able to be with us at home. My family and I were all together. We were able to speak with him and tell him how much we loved him. And even then, I was still hopeful. I was still praying to God, like, I know this is just a test of our faith. I know we just need to trust in you. I know we just need to keep praying, and then you'll come through for us. You'll heal him. You'll perform a miracle. And then I remember before my dad passed away, when he was very, very sick, he said, don't ever blame God for the things that we go through in this life, because this life isn't ours. It belongs to God. You know, if God wants to take it back, then so be it. And then he told us, this life isn't all that we have. Our true home is in the holy city. It's in heaven. So we just need to hold on to our faith so we can see each other again. He also taught me about prayer. You know, ever since I was young, he was always teaching me about prayer. Even in his last days, he said, even if God doesn't answer our prayers right away, or he doesn't respond with an answer that we want, does that mean we're going to stop praying to him? Does that mean we're going to stop loving him? And of course, no. You know, all the more we need to trust God, right, and show God that we love him by always praying to him and worshiping him no matter what. He taught me that. He said, love God no matter what.
It was one of the last things that he said to you.
Yes, it was July 13, 2004. I woke up instantly to crying, wailing, just loud, mournful tears falling from everybody's eyes. I ran downstairs and saw just everyone crying because my dad had passed away in his sleep. I said to myself, I said, this is it. This is what my dad was talking about. I didn't understand. I didn't understand why God would take a life that was so faithful, so good. Only God knows. And, you know, I had to listen to my dad. I can't be angry at God for taking his life. I can't stop loving God just because God didn't answer my prayer that was in my heart this whole time. So I said, you know, this is what my dad was talking about.
Your dad was really correct, Constance Joy. It was when he told you that we have to accept God's answer. It's not that he did not answer. It's just that he did not give the answer that you were hoping for. When that particular request that you and your family had, God's answer was, no, that's not the plan. That's not my will. You know, obviously, God had a different plan. And as hard as that was for you, it fulfilled the plan and will of God for all of you in whatever way God intended. By the way, Sister Constance, thank you so much for sharing that story, because it's not only you that experienced such kind of grief. There are many who may be joining us in this podcast that have experienced a similar kind of sadness.
Definitely.
You sharing your story so openly and with that raw essence of emotion that you included is helpful to them, to know that they're not alone in sharing the kind of grief that they experienced. But I want to share a story with Constance Joy and others who may have experienced that. There was a time before I was an ordained minister, which is obviously decades ago, so as you can imagine how many years ago it was. But nevertheless, it's a moment that remains fresh in my mind like it was yesterday. There was a couple close to us, and they had been so many years trying to have children, and they were not able. And then finally, God gave them a child. But the child was born with a heart defect. And I was born and needed surgery right away, and then needed surgery again when the child was 2 years old. So they had 2 years of various medical appointments and all of that. And they were going through all of that, but they were just so happy to have their brand new baby boy in their life. And they was to have a third surgery. This was all predicted right at the beginning. It would be a three surgery process. First two surgeries went very well. The third did not. The little boy was very sick in the intensive care, and the medical personnel all told the parents that, "I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. Your little boy's got only such a very short moments even to live." Oh, you can imagine how traumatic that was. I was there with them in the ICU. You know, the hospital was so nice. They brought in this little rocking chair. And the family had no choice, but they disconnected all of the various life support connections and this and that. And they told the couple, "Oh, your baby boy would live for maybe 2, at the most 3 minutes. He will just gradually just go to sleep and pass away." So they unhooked the baby boy, gave the boy in the arms of the mother. And she sat in that rocking chair, and she rocked that little baby. And the 2 minutes passed by, and it was approaching the third minute, and everybody was expecting the little boy would stop breathing. And then 3 minutes passed, and everybody, you know, starts looking at each other a little bit, and, you know, you could see in the eyes of the parents, "Oh boy, maybe God is answering a miraculous request or a request for a miracle here." 4 minutes came. 5 minutes passed. That little boy is still breathing. 6 minutes, 7 minutes passed, 8 minutes. Well, by 8 minutes, you can just imagine the excitement. This boy's totally disconnected from all the life support, no breathing tubes, and all whatever else they do when they connect all those things, you know? And 8 minutes passed. That boy is breathing.
Thank you for listening to part one of Millennial in Mourning. Stay tuned for part two, where we find out what happened to that little boy, how Constance Joy reacted to the loss of another loved one in her life, and spiritual verses from Brother Bob.